If two people with different values come together and come to understand each other's values, their relationship will last as long as two people whose values were the same in the first place, right? So getting the understanding of the other party is really foundational to an effective relationship.
Hello and welcome to The Daily Helping with Dr. Richard Schuster. Food for the brain, knowledge from the experts, tools to win at life. I'm your host, Dr. Richard. Whoever you are, wherever you're from, and whatever you do, this is the show that is going to help you become the best version of yourself. Each episode, you will hear from some of the most amazing, talented, and successful people on the planet who followed their passions and strive to help others. Join our movement to get 1 million people each day to commit acts of kindness for others. Together, we're going to make the world a better place. Are you ready? Because it's time for your Daily Helping.
Thanks for tuning into this episode of the Daily Helping Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Richard, and I am so unbelievably excited to share our guest with you today. His name is Paul Ingram, and he is the Kravis Professor of Business at the Columbia Business School. He has received Columbia's highest recognition for teaching, the Presidential Award for Excellence in Teaching, as well as the Dean's Award for Teaching Excellence, and 13 teaching awards voted by graduating students at Columbia and Cornell University. So clearly he can teach. His research has been published in more than 100 articles, book chapters, and books. But today he's here to talk about his newest book, What Do You Really Stand For? The One Question That Will Transform Your Work and Life. I've been excited about this one, Paul. Welcome to the Daily Helping. I am so grateful you're with us today.
Thank you, Dr. Richard. It's great to be with you.
So you've got some teaching accolades. So I'm very excited for you to teach us. And before we get into the book, I do want to jump into the Paul Ingram time machine with you a little bit today. Take us back to some of these key moments that put you on the path you're on today.
Yeah. Key moments in terms of my professional life or the project?
I would say your professional journey, and then we'll talk about the project.
So I think I'd point to two kind of turning points. One is, you know, I'm a professor of business, you know, so my job is really doing original research and teaching. And I started off, I entered on that path with a little bit of happenstance. You know, I had been an undergraduate student of accounting, and I had loved that work as a student, and I hadn't loved my work as an accountant. So I found it was a little bit dry, but I loved being a student in the space of business. So I decided I would go off to graduate school, and you apply to graduate school. I was a Canadian, and the top schools at that time were in the United States. So I made my applications, and I didn't really know what I was getting in for. I thought that I was on the path to something like a super MBA, when actually, you know, a graduate school in a business school for PhD program is really a research degree. And I remember my first meeting, it was at Cornell with the prof who became my dissertation advisor. His name is John Friedman. And we had, you know, a small fight because I was quite naive at the age of 21 or 22 as to what I was getting into. And he was, you know, laying down the reality to me about the nature of such a degree. And it turned out that probably if I'd had other options at that moment, I might have chosen one of them because it didn't seem like what I wanted to do for the next 40 or 50 years of my career. But I ended up at Cornell, and it just happened that it was perfect for me. I love the autonomy, the pursuit of original ideas, the people I was interacting with. So I kind of stumbled in without really knowing what I was getting into to a great career. And then I'll point to a key moment. I was about three or four years into my first job as a professor, which was at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. And I was teamed to co-teach with a fellow named Dick Seyert. Dick Seyert was a notable economist. He was an important economist in the economics of information organizations. But he'd really made his biggest impact as the president of Carnegie Mellon University. So he was president really when it came from being a regional to a national university and kind of steered it in that direction by being very strategic. Anyway, when I met Dick, he was in his 70s. He was suffering, had some health challenges, and he had to be teamed with a younger scholar to support him teaching a class. So that was me, and we ended up teaching a class on strategy together. And he became really the closest thing to a mentor I've had in my career. What was it? You know, I think he took a real personal interest in me. We had values in common, values like excellence and family. And we just clicked. And, you know, this 25-year-old and this 75-year-old would be having lunch together or going to the Pirates game. And he gave me a lot of advice about my career and beyond. Probably made it more certain that I would stay on a good track. So I've been lucky to run into some people who've changed my life and career for the better.
I think everybody who has achieved some degree of success would share that there's always been a mentor, a figurehead who popped up kind of at the right time to make sure that we walk the path we were supposed to walk. Okay, so thank you for sharing that. I love that story. So now let's talk about this book, because this is so interesting. You're a business professor with a gazillion business professory kind of accolades, right? If professory is a word. And you wrote this book, What Do You Really Stand For? Which on its face doesn't scream this is a business book. But of course, there's business applications. So talk us through that, Paul.
You know, at the heart of the book is putting your values to practical use, right? So being clear about your values and then employing them. That matters in every walk of life. It matters in every domain of life. It matters in your family. It matters in your interactions with community, and it certainly matters at work. So how do people be effective as leaders, as individual producers, as architects of organization? I think values are one of the surest levers that we have to pull in that space. So that's how it relates to business. And I'll talk a little bit about how I connected to the topic, which was in the domain of a program that I ran for almost 20 years. I ran Columbia's program for senior executives. So this was a month-long residential program that people from, you know, from the military, from the world of medicine or politics, or of course from business, they'd come to Columbia for a month and they would study leadership and strategy. And there was a lot of elements of that program that were beyond just learning traditional business topics. So a lot of it was about self-awareness and self-discovery as a foundation for self-regulation. And one of the elements that had been a longstanding part of the program was a coaching session in the space of values. So this was done by a career coach, a professional coach, would help the leaders surface their values. Now, at that time, in my career up to that point, I never taught anything about values. I hadn't done any original research on values. I wasn't really very aware of others' research on the topic. But I noticed something almost immediately, that I would see these successful, mature people come out of these coaching sessions, and very often they were bouncing down the hallways. They were ecstatic. You know, it was like they were lighter than air. And they felt that they'd been transformed in this discussion about values. And that got me really curious. Now, I was also open to a lot of possibilities. Maybe they like talking about their values, but does it really help them do things better? But my curiosity drove me to try to answer questions like that. So I set out doing my own research, learning about the research of others. And when I came across was that really clarity around your values can have a massive impact on your efficacy professionally, your well-being, your relationships, and beyond. And as a function of that, I really have built probably the foundation of both my teaching and research in the last 20 years on this topic.
I love the topic of values because it defines who you are. And a lot of times when we have hard decisions to make, the right answer doesn't always seem clear. If we have this foundational framework that we can draw back to, doesn't mean the answer will always be right, but it's the right answer for us, right? And it makes that easier. So I'm excited to learn. You've been in this space for decades. Talk to us about what your research and values bore out. And then my second question is, what was the most surprising thing that the research bore out that you weren't expecting to see?
In terms of the evidence, the research on what we can do with clarity around our values, I would suggest we can talk about it at three different levels. Personal level, leading oneself, relationships, and then we could get to organizations. So in the space of leading oneself, I would say that in my awareness, I think clarity around values is the most powerful tool that I know for helping people regulate themselves and achieve the benefits of personal leadership more directly and reliably. Right? So in terms of what I have to teach people in this space, helping them become clear about their values is, I think, the best I have to offer. What does it do for you? Well, we've got a lot of the best kind of causal evidence in this space in terms of experiments, right? So the kind of pattern in many of these experiments is we remind some people of their values, other people do some other activity which isn't related to their values, and then we test them in terms of ethics or performance or openness, et cetera. And we find reliably in almost all instances that people who are reminded of their values are more effective. So in my own research in that space, I found that people think about their values and they're more ethical. They feel more authentic. They are more resilient. Their stress goes down. Cortisol, the stress hormone, decreases if you think about your values. People are more motivated. So our purest form of motivation, as I think you know, Dr. Richard, is intrinsic motivation. So motivation from within. And the most powerful form of intrinsic motivation is doing what we view as important. And it is our values that tell us what's important. Right? So our values are principles of evaluation. They tell us what's good, bad, or important. So your most powerful intrinsic motivation is actually driven by values. And evidence from experiments, including long-term experiments that look at performance over time, shows that if an individual can attach an activity or a goal to their values, if they can say, look, you know, working harder on my schoolwork is a way to achieve my value of accomplishment, say, then actually their performance improves more in the long run, right? So performance, how we feel in the moment, all those things are driven by having our values top of mind. Relationally, some of my own work has been on networks and relationships and how they're affected by values. And I find that among the most important predictors about who comes friends with whom, who gravitates towards each other in relationships, is do they have more similar values? In fact, in my research, which are on business friendships, the biggest predictors about who you will connect in that kind of relationship with are who has more similar values to you and who do you have more access to, who's in the next office or who do you encounter more often on Teams and so on, right? So similarity on values matters more than demographic similarity. It matters more then do they seem like they would pay off in terms of your business interests, right? So it's really foundational relationships. And then at the level of organizations. So I really think about values as being a way to make organizational culture more tangible and therefore more manageable. So cultures are aggregations of the values and beliefs of people in some system. If you ask just about anybody, including top leaders, what are the biggest drivers of the performance of a group or an organization, their most likely answer is culture. But at the same time, most leaders don't spend the majority of their time shaping the culture. They spend it on different things, even though they think of culture as most important. How do you explain that gap? Well, I think a big part of it is that while the culture is important and understood to be important, it's also intangible, amorphous, and therefore hard to shape, hard to be intentional as a leader. If you can be clear about the values of the people on a team or a group or in a place of worship or a club or, of course, a company, then you can actually map out the culture. And you can locate the hotspots in the culture, the values that people agree on. And you can use that to build organizations that are better for performance and that the people who participate in the organizations get more value out of. And I'll take that last point about the value to the individual to answer your question about what surprised me most. So I have, over the years, done bits of research in the space of well-being. So studying life satisfaction, happiness, and so on, and what predicts that. And one of the experiments I did was on the effect of one bringing their values to top of mind on their life satisfaction. And I had the typical experimental paradigm. I have an experimental group that is reminded of their values before they assess their life satisfaction, and a control group. And in this case, I also knew other things about these subjects, including I knew their annual income. And annual income is a positive thing for life satisfaction, maybe not the biggest thing, but people who earn more money are generally happier. So I did a statistical analysis of multiple regression, which told me the effect of having one's values top of mind on happiness and the effect of $10,000 worth of income on happiness, which means that I could equate those two, and I can put thinking about your values in terms of its dollar equivalents in terms of the effect on happiness. And it turns out having your values top of mind, according to that study, created about as much happiness as the average person would expect to get from $87,000 worth of annual income. And sometimes I tell people that and they say, oh, knowing your values is like worth $87,000. But actually, that's really an underestimate because that's annual income. And when you do some work to become clear about your values, you've got the opportunity to tap into that benefit every year for the rest of your life. So it's much more like an annuity of happiness over time, right? So, you know, the net present value of that annuity would be in the millions of dollars. There's not much you can do that would make a bigger difference for your happiness than to become more clear about your values and keep that clarity top of mind.
That is such a fascinating concept, an annuity of values. I love that. So we've been talking about this, the way your book is positioned, right? The book has three parts, you, your relationships, and your team or organization. And so you said something that was kind of intriguing and on one hand, self-evident, right? That, you know, the organizations that do well and there seems to be cohesion, they seem to signal that culture, workplace culture, is this unifying kumbaya, bring everybody together. But I'm wondering, does your research indicate when you were putting this book together that people see values as part of workplace culture? Are they separate? Is it muddy? What did you find there?
Yeah. So there's lots of definitions of culture. And the academic definitions of culture have three elements: values, beliefs, and norms, which are patterns of behavior. Often, if you were to ask somebody working in a company about the culture, they very often point to norms, right? So they'll say, oh, we're very collaborative, or we have a lot of fun at work, right? So they talk about the behaviors which are expected. So people encounter culture in that, you know, behavioral way. So if they're just talking off experience, that's often what they'll describe. But we do research on organizational culture, starting with values as the foundation. And we can interview anybody about their organization or their team, and it's quite easy to get them to articulate the values that they view as very active. We ask actually a question, sometimes different forms of the question, but we've got this one powerful question that is enough to give us a measurement of culture that allows us to predict organizational performance, individual performance, turnover, these really critical outcomes. We ask people to think of an employee who they really value and who they believe is valued by others as well. And then we just ask them to explain, why is that person valuable to them and to others? And they will say, you know, she's a great team player, or she's very focused on clients, or he gives really honest feedback, right? So they'll talk about these elements, like knowledgeable, or they'll talk about these behaviors like good communication, which are really, you know, the foundation of the culture. So values and beliefs create behaviors, right? So we ask them that question and they articulate these things, which we can call organizational values, and they allow us to really have this foundation to understand the culture, to do research on it, and to identify ways to improve it. So people talk about culture often in a very on-the-ground, day-to-day way. It's not hard to get them to think about the deeper principles that stand behind those day-to-day interactions.
Hey guys, Dr. Richard here. For the past 7 years, I've been privileged to bring you incredible guests who are changing the world and can help you become the best version of yourself. I'm really excited to share with you a new quiz that I created based on my clinical training that will curate for you a custom list of my top episodes and actionable strategies to help you wherever you are on your journey. All you need to do is go to drrichardschuster.com to take it, and it's 100% free. You'll be taking the next step on the journey to unlocking the power of you, and I can't wait to see where you'll go. So when we talk about culture, and I know, obviously, because if somebody's listening to this and they're saying, okay, this is making sense to me, but maybe I'm not so clear on my values as an individual, right? So I guess that's the million-dollar question here, right, Paul? How does one, if they don't think they're clear on what their values are, how do you get that clarity?
That is the million-dollar question. I think that's the real difference maker for an individual in terms of turning their values into a tool. Dr. Richard, how about we demonstrate this as opposed to describe it? Would you mind if I ask you a reflective question that's the kind of thing we use to get at people's values?
Sure, go right ahead.
So you've just finished a really important project, and you feel free to tell folks about that project. But we chatted a little bit. I could tell that project was important to you. It was a big deal. And I think it was very satisfying for you. Could you tell me, what was it about that project that made it so satisfying for you? What did it represent? What was the process like? Put it into a word or a couple words. And then if it was a really satisfying episode of work, there'll be more than one thing. So see if you could go, what was the most important thing that explains why it was so satisfying to you? What else, what else, and what else?
Sure. So I'll even shed light on the project, but I've actually never talked about it publicly. So I have finished my first book, and stay tuned because I'll talk a lot more about it in the future. For me, writing this book was amplifying what I get to do on this show, but in a different way. In this show, as you know, is all about helping people. And that's what makes me tick. I discovered that a long time ago. But this is helping people in a different kind of way, where I've taken things that I've lived through and galvanized that into a formula that people can use to bring the most meaning out of their work relationships, out of their personal relationships, maximize their health, and there's other things. So this was very rewarding for me. I felt honored and grateful to the people that helped me bring it to light and really fine-tune it, and just excited to share it with the world. And I've never put anything to paper that one day when my young children are old enough, they're going to read it 20 years from now, and it's like a blueprint for them, which is really special too.
Yeah, that's a beautiful answer. And it's really effective for our purposes of showing how we make values concrete, because you talked about a number of values very clearly. You talked about helping people. That seems really to be a driving value for you. You talked about finding meaning, right? So meaning is another value sometimes people articulate. Health, gratitude, excitement, family, or perhaps legacy. So I hope to get three or four values out of that exercise. You gave us six. And often when I work with people in workshops, we generate eight values, right? So people have many more than eight values, but the top values at the top matter more. And you gave us six there. So that's a really good start. Now, I wouldn't call that the end, right? So let me explain what we did there, and then I'll suggest what the next step would be. So our values are principles of evaluation. They tell us what's good, bad, or important. So if you analyze a really important project or really satisfying piece of work and you answer why, those whys are going to be values, right? So that's what you just did there. you know, did it beautifully. So that's a starting set in terms of your values. And what I would suggest that you would do next is you would just try and sharpen it, right? So we're in the right space. We've got an idea about what's important to you. But actually, getting that real activation that we find in our experiments, that when someone thinks about their values, they're happier, their stress goes down, they're more ethical. That depends on getting the label on the value just right, right? So a second round, I'll just illustrate what it might be like, would be perhaps just to check on some refinements and opportunities to maybe sharpen some of these terms. And I'll just pick one value here, health. Okay, so you said health. What's more important to you, health or well-being? If you had to have health or well-being, which would you choose?
I see them as two sides of a coin.
Two sides of a coin. Does one of the labels resonate more?
I think well-being as a label, yes, resonates more with
Okay, me. Great. So well-being. So what we've just found there is they're very close, which is actually why I chose them. And you're telling us well-being is a little bit more right for me, right? And then we might go through some other near synonyms, right? So maybe inner peace, and you might tell us whether it's inner peace or well-being is more fundamental for you. And we would do that with your set of values and ideally get to a set of labels that for you are really exciting. You know, the goal is to have labels for these values that you wouldn't trade for anything else, right? So, you know, if there was a project where you could help people, where there was meaning, where you got well-being, you felt gratitude, excitement, and it led to satisfying your value of family or legacy, would you want anything more than that? And we want to get the label such your answer would be no, that would be the ideal project.
That was a fun exercise.
Yeah, thank you. Well, thanks for engaging.
And, absolutely.
You know, really what we did was reflected on something good, bad, or important, took the outcome of that reflection, and then played with the words just to see if we could sharpen them.
And I presume then this is an exercise that we would take into the boardroom and we could do this with teams.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of my work in the classroom, both degree students and companies, is doing workshops that are basically on this foundation. And, you know, I do it with the top leaders from global banks. I do it with the people doing social work in a social services organization in New York City. It works in all kinds of organizations. Believe it or not, people like doing it. People like the chance to talk about their values. We do it in a way where they interact with each other and kind of express and learn a little bit about each other, and it generates a lot of really positive energy.
Is there anything where doing this the wrong way or focusing on the wrong thing can lead us astray?
Yeah, that's a big question. I take that question very seriously. And I would say, you know, my short answer on that is that I don't think we're ever worse off by having clarity around our values, right? So I think it is only to the good. Now, could we make a mistake in the process and come up with a false set of values? And is it good for us to be walking around with a false set of values? Well, it's possible to make a mistake in any process, and it's not good for us to be walking around with a false set of values. It sort of cuts us off from our own best self. How does the process go wrong? Well, the process goes wrong when people are more the should, you know, this should be my value than what the value truly is, right? So, you know, we did that little engagement, you know, quickly, but, you know, if we were spending more time on it, I would really kind of push you in terms of some of the dyadic choices. You know, we've got a strange world. In this strange world, you can only have gratitude or respect. Which would you choose if you had to choose, right? And really force people to kind of tap into their gut feeling. So the reflection helps to do that as well, because if people really remember an intense experience, they have this natural urge to be honest in trying to express what was going on there. But sometimes you've got to overcome a little bit of, you know, social expectation, right? So in practice, you know, it works very well. But between like the very beginning of the process and where we end up, often the transition is getting people out of what they think would look good as their values and really making them comfortable expressing the labels which are just most powerful to them.
I want to bring the conversation out of the workplace and into the home. And let's talk about relationships. So imagine a scenario where you have a couple who goes through this exercise and they get very granular on what their values are, and their values are wildly conflictual in nature.
Yeah.
What do we do other than just say, well, let's end the marriage. The, you know, values don't make sense, right? What happens?
I've got three insights to offer in that space. The first is that it is vanishingly unlikely that their values would be contradictory, right? Because what we find, actually, you know, I've done empirical work in the space of values with more than 10,000 people from around the world. All of those people articulate values that you and the members of your audience would look at and would say, well, those are good values. Every one of those people articulates values you would say are good. None of them says a value that you would say is contradictory to any of yours. Now, their values are never exactly like yours. And we would all say, well, their values are good. I prefer my values, but theirs are good too. You know, that's the nature of values. We think ours are the best for us. But everyone is articulating good values. Now, I'm not saying everybody in the world has good values, right? So there are estimates, which seem about right, given my own experience, that 1% of even successful people are psychopaths. And if you ask a psychopath about their values, they'll lie about their values. They'll say they're good things. When really, I think one way to understand psychopathy is just the absence of values, right? So not everybody is pursuing good values, but 99% of the people in the world are, right? So what you're going to find if you were to do this exercise with your partner or spouse, and it was maximally different, is that they'd be articulating values that would say, well, those are good things, but they're, I think mine are better, right? And there wouldn't be a lot of overlap, right? So one party might be saying creativity is good and the other might be saying excellence is good. One might be saying legacy is good. The other might be saying pleasure is good, right? So even if you really care about legacy, you can recognize pleasure is a positive thing. More of it in the world is better than less, but they're not the same thing. So we're not going to find complete contradictions. That's first. The second is hopefully good news that, you know, I'll go back to the research I shared about what initially draws us to people. We connect based on commonalities and values, right? So most often we find that, say, people in a very close relationship will have insignificant commonalities, right? So they might put different labels on their values, but they could recognize that there's a lot of common ground, right? So that's quite likely. Not always. The possibility that you describe that they could be positive, but very different. Of course, that can happen. In that circumstance, what I would say is, and again, we've got experimental evidence of this, is that you're still much better for having had the conversation. What we find in our research on relationships is we gravitate towards somebody because their values are similar to ours, most likely. But if we connect with them for some other reason, like we are placed in the office next to them, or we're wed in an arranged marriage, and their values are good but different, then if we can understand their values, then we can manage a productive relationship. Right. So what you would get out of the experience that you just described is that the two members of the relationship would come to a better understanding of each other, and they would be much better able to interact positively, right? So we would expect in most cases, there would be some commonality between parties to a close relationship. Even if it's different, they can get along if they understand their values. And we haven't studied the duration of marriages, but when we look at friendships, if two people with different values come together and come to understand each other's values, their relationship will last as long as two people whose values were the same in the first place, right? So getting the understanding of the other party is really foundational to an effective relationship.
And you kind of beat me to the punch there, because as you haven't studied marital length, I was wondering if there was any research around if people discuss values, even if they have some dissimilar values, do those marriages tend to be more stable and last longer than those that don't?
Yeah, I'd be extrapolating from work on other relationships, but my answer would be yes. And I'll give you a little bit of anecdotal evidence that one of the challenges I give people when they're in my classes or workshops on values is to go find a relationship that they'd like to improve and have a discussion about values with that person. And it's quite routine that people will choose their partner or spouse. And they always come back and say that the discussion was a positive step for the relationship. I've never had someone return and say, oh, we had this discussion and it was really bad for our relationship. It's always a positive thing, right? So anecdotally, extrapolating from some other systematic research, communicating your values, I would be confident in saying is a step in the right direction for a marriage.
Outstanding. Paul, I have loved every second of our time together today. As you know, I wrap up every episode by asking my guests a single question, and that is, what is your biggest helping, that one most important piece of information you'd like somebody to walk away with after hearing our conversation?
Oh, thanks, Dr. Richard. So what I would love for people to take away from this conversation is a motivation. First, yes, to do the work like I did in my reflection interview with Dr. Richard to clarify, surface and clarify their values. But then take the next step of making the values concrete and accessible. Right. So my students, some of them over 20 years, often carry around a laminated card in their wallets that represents their top values. I'll run into somebody in the airport in Paris and they'll say, oh, professor, I was your student 10 years ago. I want to show you I still have my values. I have my values on a coffee mug that my students actually gave me as a gift. And if I'm going into a stressful meeting, I bring my my values coffee mug so I can check in and consult it in the moment. Every day before I step into my office at the Columbia Business School, I pause outside the doors and I take out my value structure. I keep mine on a card in my wallet. And I spend 30 seconds thinking about the values, thinking about how they're in play in terms of what I have planned for the day, thinking about challenges I might have to realizing the values. It grounds me. I feel my stress go down. It improves my self-regulation and produces well-being and happiness, maybe the ultimate outcome. So I would love people to access those benefits.
That is fantastic. This was such an amazing conversation, Paul. The book is What Do You Really Stand For? The One Question That Will Transform Your Work and Life. That's available everywhere books are sold. But if people want to learn more about you, Paul, where can they find you online?
Look up Columbia Business School Paul Ingram, and you'll get all my access, including my email. I love to hear from people who are putting values into action, trying this out, and you know, I'll hear your questions and hopefully your examples of success. So I'm easy to find at the Columbia Business School.
Perfect. We'll make it even easier. Everything Paul Ingram, including a link to the book, will be featured in the show notes at drrichardschuster.com. Well, Paul, what a blast. How informative. How awesome. Thank you so much for joining us today. I love the chat.
Thanks, Dr. Richard. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you. And thank you as well to each and every one of you who took time out of your day to listen to this chat. If you're going to go figure out what your values are, grab this book. Go give us a follow and a 5-star review on the podcast app of your choice, because this is what helps other people find the show. But most importantly, go out there today and do something nice for somebody else, even if you don't know who they are, and post it in your feeds using the hashtag MyDailyHelping, because the happiest people are those that help others.